This is the full-length version of the interview that Dave recorded with Brother Guy Consolmagno, one of the Vatican astronomers.
So, welcome to the Jodcast, Brother Guy. Now, you are currently president of Commission 16, which is the commission on behalf of planets and moons with the International Astronomical Union. And one of the questions that our listeners would quite like to know is, what is the planetary status of Xena, that new planet that was discovered, and also Pluto as well?
Well, there's two things we can say for certain. However many planets there are in the solar system, it's not nine. And the other thing we can say for certain is whatever we're going to call UB313, it won't be Xena, which is a shame because it's kind of a charming name. The rest of the answer is we don't know. There was a big committee put together about a year ago by the IAU, chaired by an Englishman, Ewan Williams, and we argued ferociously and came to no conclusion. The difficulty is that in some ways we don't know enough. We don't really know what's out there. We don't know where an intelligent place to draw the line is. Even since that committee met, I've changed my mind twice more, in my own opinion. And I'm beginning to really like the idea that there is a difference between asteroids and moons that are rubble piles, where the only geology that occurs on them is impacts, versus coherent bodies that are big enough to maybe have differentiation and melting and other kinds of geological activity on them. If you use that as a definition, you could argue very convincingly that there's a boundary at about 10 to the 20 kilograms of mass, and above that would be a planet. That being the case, not only would Pluto continue to be a planet, and UB313 and EL61 and a handful, easily, another 10 of these Kuiper Belt objects, but also Ceres and Vesta would qualify as planets. And so suddenly we'd have a solar system with two dozen planets or more. Now, does this make people uncomfortable? There's no answer that won't make people uncomfortable. But any other obvious answer you'd come to, you suddenly realize there's a hole in it. For instance, let's just say there are eight really big guys and Pluto was a mistake. That's sort of the second most popular answer at this point. The trouble with that is we know there's this object called Sedna, which is in a very peculiar orbit, which must have been perturbed into that orbit, possibly by an object at 100, 200 AU, which could be half the size of Mercury, and we wouldn't have seen it. And suddenly, if there is such an object, or two such objects, or five such objects, then there's no longer this nice clear break between the eight big guys and all the little guys. You also worry about what kind of definition can you come up with that's useful for looking at planets around other stars, where, again, you don't know if there's going to be a clean-cut break. I do think that the Kuiper Belt objects that are very big are a distinct breed of object compared to the Kuiper Belt objects that are smaller, and distinct from the gas giants, and distinct from the terrestrial planets. We have to come up with a new name for them. But we also have to come up with a decision fairly soon so that we can stop calling it Xena and come up with a name that fits either the rules for asteroids or the rules for planets. In fact, the IAU, having not gotten a good answer out of its first committee, has put together a second committee. And these are people who have more contact with the history of science, with journalism, with, and ultimately they're going to have to come up with an arbitrary choice. But it's not going to be the final answer.
Isn't it the case, though, that nomenclature, the naming, what these things are, isn't actually important, whether we call them planets, planetoids, asteroids, or whatever? Surely we just need to know where they are so that we can study them.
You'd think that. The longer you look into it, the more you realize that nomenclature and classification is a fundamental thing that science does for some very practical reasons, besides figuring out how to name them. It tells you what tools you bring to study them. And that's why now I would argue that you'd classify things in terms of the tools you need. If you need to have a degree in geology to figure out their surfaces, they're a planet. If you don't, they're an asteroid. But knowing ahead of time what kind of object they are changes the way you think about the solar system. I can come up with a model for the solar system that explains the gas giants and everything else is just trash left over. If I'm going to insist that I can also explain the terrestrial planets, I need a more sophisticated model. It really changes the way you ask the questions and the kind of questions you ask.
Thank you. So just coming back into what we know as the solar system, fairly classic question for you. What is your idea for life in the solar system, for example, on things like Europa, Enceladus, everything like that? What are our chances?
I think our chances are good. I would be delighted to find some sort of life someplace. 10 years ago, when they first saw that meteorite from Mars that they thought might have evidence of life in it, my suspicion then was, in 100 years, we'll know there was life on Mars, and it wasn't this. And I think that's probably being borne out by what we're seeing. I think we're changing a lot of our ideas about what life is, what life does to a planet. The things that I learned 25 years ago, the things that I taught 10 years ago, I would change now. And that's exciting. I'd say the best places to look for life now are probably Enceladus is certainly exciting. It's got liquid water right now. And that liquid water is in contact with the surface, which means not only that you can have sunlight, you still need sunlight, even for deep ocean life, because even the stuff that's hanging around the vents in the deep part of the ocean on Earth is still using some free oxygen in the water that it's getting from the top of the ocean. And as far as, you know, the only kind of life we know about now still needs some input from the sun to free up some kind of free oxygen. And Enceladus has that. When you've got contact with the surface, you can have currents then from the plasma around Saturn that create electrical currents within the oceans, which are going to be conductors because they're going to have dissolved minerals in them. And that can lead to heating, and that can lead to the energy that gives you. I think it's a very exciting place to look for life. The other thing is, it's a whole lot easier to get to than Europa, because Europa is deep inside Jupiter's magnetic field, and the plasma and the radiation problems of landing on Europa and surviving long enough to do any science aren't nearly as serious at Enceladus. So I'd say that's become, in a lot of people's minds, the number one place to go and look.
Going to your Catholic roots now, firstly, why does the Pope need an astronomer? And secondly, what is the Pope's view on things like cosmology? We have a new Pope. Mm-hmm. Has the view of the universe changed in the time between the popes?
Well, first of all, the history of astronomy in the Church goes back to the reform of the calendar in 1582. And even earlier than that, where is astronomy studied? At universities. Who founded the universities and has run most of the universities in most of the world for most of our history? Astronomy was one of the four subjects that you had to master before you could go on to theology and philosophy. So that's certainly key. In the religions that believe in a creator God, specifically Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, these are also the cultures that have supported science. Because not only do you have a reason to believe that the universe will make sense because some nice God made it rather than just chaos, but you also have a way of convincing the powers that be that this is worth spending some money doing. And it's an issue that, you know, scientists face to this day. But the fact that the culture in general would see studying pure science for its own sake as a form of worship is what has fueled science throughout our history. The current Pope has published on cosmology. He has published on his view of the universe. It's very congruent, actually, with what the previous Pope had written. Both of them see that science is a good thing, that scientific knowledge is a good thing, that science has to be free to pursue its knowledge. And yet, at the same time, you can't think that science is the only thing there is. I had an interview with someone else who was talking about this, and he sort of came to the conclusion that I know scientists who think that the world begins and ends in physics, and they're really boring people, which is telling you something. Life is more than that. But on the other hand, I also know people who don't appreciate physics and don't know science, and they're just a little bit boring, too.
So when it comes to the Pope and his views, some people's view of the Catholic Church is that you have the papal infallibility. And one question that came up was, if the Pope decided that all science was a bad thing, or that cosmology meant that the world was only 6,000 years old, where would that put you as a scientist?
Well, I'm reminded of the old joke that of why Richard Dawkins could never be Pope, because then he would no longer be infallible. People don't understand what infallibility is. It is one of these things which is so carefully defined that you recognize, in fact, it's saying most of the time, most of the things the Pope says isn't and can't be infallible. The only things that a Pope can say that are considered infallible are issues of faith that have already been confirmed by the entire history of the Church. He can't come up with anything novel and different and change your mind. Guess what? There are four members of the Trinity now instead of three. Not going to fly. So by definition, the sorts of things you're talking about could not be infallible statements. I think it was best put by John Paul II, truth doesn't contradict truth. So the entire history of Christianity has been that when what we thought we understood is challenged by something new, you step back and say, oh, I guess I didn't understand it as well as I thought. And frankly, that's the way it works in science as well.
In your work as one of the papal astronomers, where do you actually do your observations? Where is your base of operation?
My base of operation is Castel Gandolfo, which is the Pope's summer home. And that's where the Vatican has its meteorite collection. And that's the core of my work, is working on meteorites, working out their physical structure, their density, their porosity, their strength, and what that tells us about what was going on when the meteorites were being formed 4.5 billion years ago. On the other hand, I also do observational astronomy. We've got a number of telescopes in Castel Gandolfo that are pre-war, and they're beautiful telescopes, but the sky isn't so beautiful there anymore. So about 15 years ago, the Vatican allowed us permission to use their name to raise the money to build a new telescope in southern Arizona. And so for part of the year, I'm in southern Arizona using the world's first spin-cast mirror telescope. This is the technology that's going into the LBT, the large binocular telescope, that has gone into the MMT, which used to be the multi-mirror telescope, but it's now one massive 6.5-meter piece of glass. Part of that is we're in partnership with the University of Arizona. We've got offices physically on campus at the University of Arizona, which is a state university, curiously enough. And it means that through them, we have access to all of the other telescopes of the University of Arizona. And we have access, I have as an American citizen, to any of the telescopes supported by the National Science Foundation. Also, I collaborate with other people who can apply for telescope time. So I've used the Keck. I've used the MMT. I've used telescopes on Kitt Peak. But the one that I use the most is it's small, 1.8-meter piece of glass, but its focal length is also 1.8 meters. It is an F1 mirror, and it is a glorious mirror. One of the things that comes out of this is, because it's such a fast telescope, you know how most telescopes have a secondary mirror, which is actually not flat. It has to be slightly curved, so it focuses off axis. Traditionally, because mirrors are pretty slow, you had a convex secondary, which is very difficult to test, very difficult to get precise. We actually have a light path where the light comes to a focus and goes beyond the focus before you have the secondary mirror, and the secondary mirror is concave. It's called Gregorian optics. Nobody has ever made such a large Gregorian telescope before. As Chris Corbelly, our director in Tucson, points out, we took a Gregorian chance when we built this telescope. But on the other hand, the mirror itself was made by, and I'm not making this up, Roger Angel. So we've got a telescope made by an angel that has successfully taken a Gregorian chance. The result is, between the wonderful optics and the very dark skies and the very still skies, because we're at over 10,000 feet, it's well over 3,000 meters, we can outperform telescopes that are significantly larger, simply because we can focus finer. Without any adaptive optics, we regularly get 0.8 arc seconds. And that means that, you know, the things I look at are Kuiper Belt objects, which are pretty faint. We can see things down to 23rd magnitude in a 5-minute exposure and do useful science on it.
That must be such a fantastic job.
I can't believe that I get paid to do this. It's simply, you know, when I entered the Jesuits, I was already had been an astronomer. I was nearly 40 years old. I thought I would wind up spending the rest of my life teaching. But I took this vow of obedience. And so when they ordered me to go to Rome and eat that terrible Italian food and look at that boring scenery and play with these meteorites and then spend some time using the state-of-the-art telescope, I had to obey. You know, that's what obedience is all about.
And finally, just got time for one last question. It's probably one you've been asked many times before, but if we encounter aliens that have no concept of religion or a creator god, how would that affect your faith?
I would be fascinated. I would also be very surprised, because I think any creature that has an intellect, is able to ask questions about what's out there, and has free will, the ability to do something about the questions it asks, that's Thomas Aquinas' definition of a soul. And one of the questions we all ask is, where did we come from? What's this all about? Why is there something instead of nothing? What am I supposed to be doing with my life? These are questions that come with having an intellect and a free will. And we all come up with different answers. And within a religion, we all come up with different answers. And we have different answers at different times in our life. I can't help but think that they would also have the same sorts of questions. And if we were able to communicate at all, we'd learn a lot from each other. It's not so much that would you proselytize. You couldn't help both learn and talk to. It's the best parallel we have is when Westerners from Western Europe went to the other parts of the world and encountered other cultures. And yes, we had missionaries and talked to them, which meant that we were treating them as equals. But we also learned in an awful lot. And our culture has been enriched by the things we've learned from other cultures. I would hope the same thing would happen again, without the plagues and without the, you know, the other bad things that we also, as human beings, are capable of doing to each other.
Brother Guy, thank you very much.
It's been delightful to be here.